Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Shane Murphy, and today I'm interviewing Cheryl Smith, PhD, a clinical psychologist from Cheshire, Connecticut. She has a private practice and specializes in psychophysiology and sports psychology.
Well, can I call you Cheryl?
Yeah.
Thanks again for taking the time to do this. So just picking up on what Vladimir said, that you know this is a course where we actually get to find out what people do in the mental health field. So can you start off perhaps by just telling us a little bit about what you do?
Yes, well, thank you for having me and being interested in what I do. I'm a clinical and sports psychologist, so I've got a split there with what I do. I have clinical patients I see in my office who come to me. And then for sports psychology, I see athletes who come to my office and I work with them individually. And I also work in the athletic departments of a couple different universities. I go to them and work with teams there, and occasionally I work with individuals there as well.
What would a typical day be like for you?
There is no typical day,
okay.
Given that I have a wide range of things I do. It ranges, but it wouldn't be surprising for me to see clinical patients in the morning and then athletes in the afternoon or evening after they come from school, or spend part of my day at one university and then come back to the office with another part of my day. Or sometimes I'm out at the venue watching people practice or compete. I had one day where I was on the golf course in the morning, and then I drove up to the International Skating Center in the afternoon, and I came back down for diving practice in the evening. So I got wet on the course, cold in the rink, and very hot in the pool.
Sorry, welcome to the world of applied sports psychology.
Yes.
So when you say you have an office, where is your office?
My office is in Cheshire, Connecticut.
And how do you get an office? Do you have to rent from somebody?
You have to go look for office space and decide if you can pay the rent, if you can be out by yourself, or if you have to be in with a group, and I'm by myself.
So when somebody comes to you, how long would they visit with you for?
My sessions are 45 minutes. The first one is often an hour. It's my intake, where I try and find out as much as possible about the background and the current state of things. But my working sessions are 45 minutes.
Okay. And in terms of payment, is it different for like the clinical people versus the sports psych clients?
It is, yes. For clinical patients, they all pay me through insurance. I don't have anyone who's out of pocket, though that would be nice. That means that I need to apply to and be accepted onto insurance panels of different insurance companies. So I would ask them if I could be a provider for them, and they would vet me out, look over my credentials, and see if I meet their criteria, and then I would have to sign a negotiated fee agreement that I agree to take whatever fee they choose to give me for my services, regardless as to whatever fees I currently have. And they are usually about 3/4 to half of what I usually charge.
And so the sports psychology clients are different?
Yes, they have to pay out of pocket, because medical insurance does not pay for performance enhancement. Because I'm also a clinical psychologist, occasionally I will run into a diagnosable condition with an athlete, and at that point we will have to decide, do we want to move into, say, working on through major depression or anxiety disorder, eating disorder, and focus on that and go through insurance, or do I refer to someone else for that, and they stay with me for the performance.
So how much would a 45-minute session cost for sports psychology?
So the way I've done it, and there's some discussion around whether we should be discussing fees or not, but the way I've done it is I charge $125 for the first hour and $110 for every hour after that for adults and college students. But I have split my fees in half for the little ones to get them into mental training early.
Interesting. So let's go back a little bit. What first got you interested in mental health and psychology?
I did not know what a psychologist did. I was in college and I was an athlete and I was not a very good student and not very motivated. I was taking all sorts of courses. I tried to find something that I liked, and I took a psychology course and I really liked it. It was a research course and I really liked it. And I wanted to do more of it. I felt like I found my people. I felt like they think like I do, or, oh yeah, I've been a psychologist all this time and I didn't know it. And I took more psychology courses and I knew I wanted to do more in this, and that motivated me to learn how to be a good student.
So where was that? You were in college?
At Wesleyan University here in Connecticut.
In Connecticut, okay. And when you say you were an athlete, so what sports did you do?
Well, I'll go back even further. I grew up as a competitive figure skater. I had that life of being on the ice in the morning and getting a special dispensation to come to school late and leave early and then be back on the ice. I spent my summers with host families, following my coach around. Wherever he was, I went. And figure skating was a huge part of my identity, but I wasn't good enough to make a career of it. So, and I knew I wanted to go to college. When I went to college, I was in the process of transitioning out of my sport, which is extremely difficult for me. I tried not to transition. I tried to stay a figure skater, and that was a disaster, really. But my university back in the 70s had a women's ice hockey team that had just been started the year before. And I decided to try out for that and see if I could make the switch. And I did. And that, I think, was a real pivotal point, because I connected to people. And it was right after Title IX, so we had a lot of opportunities. And there was a group of female athletes who sort of just went from sport to sport. So I played 1 year of lacrosse, and we started a soccer team, and I played many years of ice hockey, and then I switched to track and ran track for 2 years.
Wow, what a varied experience.
Yes, lots of experience.
So how did you decide to go to grad school, and how did you choose a graduate program?
I chose the graduate program that would accept me. They chose me. It's a little late to try and become a good student as a junior. I encourage all of you to learn that early.
It's too late for them. Graduating.
If you haven't learned it, learn it now. So I did not get into any PhD programs, and I, for some reason, applied to a little tiny program in the middle of Illinois, because some of my best friends were going to school in Illinois. So it was called Sangamon State University, and they accepted me in their master's degree program. In my great good fortune, University of Illinois absorbed them, so now my transcript says that I went to the University of Illinois. but I didn't. So I went there and I proved myself and I did really well. And then I applied out to come back, and I was hoping to come back to Connecticut, and UConn accepted me.
So what was the program at UConn like? Can you tell us a little bit about that. How was it structured?
Can you give me more of what you're looking for? How was it structured and what
was it? So was it a clinical PhD program? Was it a PsyD program?
Oh, it's a clinical PhD program. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we did 2 years of coursework and then practica, and then we took qualifying exams to be admitted into candidacy. We went on our internships before our getting our PhD.
This just occurred to me because we talked about it last week, but the Boulder model, you know, clinical PhD is so important.
Yes, it was very Boulder model,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of that?
I loved it because I really enjoyed the research, and I didn't know really what a clinical psychologist was. I was into thinking and discovering and trying to understand. I had no idea what to do with that information. So I liked that.
Where did you do your internship?
I went to Yale, the Yale Medical School, for my internship. I was interested in behavioral medicine, and I worked a little bit with Gary Schwartz in psychophysiology, so that began my interest in psychophysiology.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that in a second. I was just talking with Diana Nadeo, who we're going to interview next week, and we were talking about how stressful match day was where you apply for your internship and then find out if they accept you or not. Was that a stressful day for you?
I don't have a clear recollection of it. I'm sure it was. The stressful thing that I remembered was that I got a call to interview at Yale, and I had just had my appendix out. And I was actually in the hospital when I got the call, and I said yes. So the next week, I still had my bandages on, and I was sort of hunched over, and I had my interview that way.
Wow. But obviously they still liked you.
They must have.
I'm making this up as I go along. Would you mind if we switch chairs?
Sure.
I'm just thinking, like, it give everyone a little different perspective. You can see, like, that over there. This is the drama theater major coming out in me. So, sports psychology, although it's my area, so I love it, but I'm always fascinated how somebody trained in clinical psychology gets involved in sports psychology and finds that niche. So how did that come about for you, Cheryl?
Well, of course, my background is that sports were really important to me, always. I played ice hockey for Wesleyan, I played for UConn during my graduate school, and I played down in New Haven in an independent club through my internship. So it's always been a part of my identity. But how I got into sports psychology was through psychophysiology and learning how to do biofeedback to assist in anxiety management. And athletes would come to my office for that. So that was the first.
At Yale?
No, this was in Cheshire.
Oh, Cheshire, okay. In your practice?
In my practice.
That's where it started.
Yeah. They would come for anxiety management. So that's how I first started doing sports psychology. It was just the arousal management part of it. And I decided I wanted to do the whole gamut of sports psychology. So I went back and trained and got certified.
So I sort of missed a piece there. So when you graduated, did you decide to go straight into private practice, or was there a transition period there?
When I graduated, then you need to do a postdoctoral fellowship or experience to get licensed. And I was in Pittsburgh at the time.
I was just there this weekend.
Yes, you were. And I was at the Highland Drive VA for a while, and then got licensed in Pennsylvania first, and then we moved back here to Connecticut to sit for that exam and get my Pennsylvania license. So as a clinical psychologist, you are not a clinical psychologist just because you graduate with a PhD from a clinical psychology program. You are a clinical psychologist when the state says you are, and you have to meet their criteria. So I moved back here to Connecticut and was working in my clinical practice here, independent clinical practice.
What do you remember about studying for the state exams, Pennsylvania and Connecticut?
Now that you ask me that, it does seem like I do things very stressfully. I was pregnant and I had preeclampsia, so I was actually in the hospital studying for the exam. I actually took the exam from the hospital. I left and went and took the exam, and then I came back.
Oh, my God.
So, yes, things, I get stressed out. It's very stressful.
There's an ethics component to most state exams.
Yes, there's the state regulations and ethics components.
Right. What did you feel about that part of the exam? Is that easy, hard? Common sense. You have to study the APA, you know, ethics standards carefully.
Yes, you have to know that. You have to know that. Some of it makes sense. Some of it you just have to know it in detail. But by that point, you're so used to studying things and learning things, it's you're good at it.
Mm-hmm. How important have mentors been you in your career?
Extremely important, yes. I consider myself a very independent person. I like to do things on my own, but mentors have been probably the most important influence on me in my career, the most important valuable influence on me.
So could I ask who one or two important mentors have been?
Well, I'm afraid I've forgotten their names from way back in the 80s.
You say Dr. A and Dr. B.
Dr. A and Dr. B. Beth Howlett. Dr. Beth Howlett has been my supervisor for my ASP certification, which is my sports psychology certification. And she's wonderful. And others whose names escape me have also been very important to me. Plus, since I'm in independent private practice, I'm just the only one in my office. I have weekly meetings with another colleague, and we give each other mutual supervision, and that's developed into a very close friendship.
So you mentioned ASP certification, which is the Association for Applied Sports Psychology. So is that extra training? Does it never end even after you graduate?
Yes, it never ends. Mm. It never ends. So to get certified in biofeedback, there's extra training and supervision there. To get certified as sports psychologist through ASP, there's a great deal of extra training and supervision. Karen Costello from USOC was one of my supervisors. And then in order to keep it, it's not like when you get your PhD, they give it to you and it's yours and they can't take it away. When you get certified or when you get your license, your state license, you have continuing education requirements in order to keep your certification. So I have a list of things that I have to do for my psychophysiology certificate, my ASP certificate, my Connecticut license, and my Pennsylvania license. I'm going to school a lot.
Wow. How valuable do you think those extra certifications are in your career?
I think they're very valuable. Highly valuable. 5 out of 5 valuable.
Okay. what's the best part of your work? What do you like the most about what you do?
So one of the things I really like is when I'm working with athletes, I get to stand up and walk around. For the rest of my day, I'm sitting in a very little chair, and it can be very long, but I get to move I get to move around and exercise a little bit and be in the athletic department atmosphere. But the very best thing about being a psychologist is, for me, the sense of privilege, the sense of honor I get when another person has allowed me close, has allowed me inside their psyche, who's taken the chance on trusting me and bringing me in to be with the important things in their world and hoping that maybe I can become important and trusting me. I feel honored every single time that happens.
Great. If you look back now and think about both your undergraduate, or probably more your graduate training, what were the things that best prepared you for your career, do you think? Or was there anything that you wish you had, that you didn't get at that time?
I would say my internship was very important to me. It was at Yale, is very psychoanalytic, and I was trained psychodynamically there. And I felt that when I was released into the world upon unsuspecting people, I felt I had a really good foundation. I felt that I was very well trained, and it helped my confidence.
So the internship was really
a critical
turning point for you.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Gary Schwartz, so for the class, they may not know that name, but very instrumental figure in biofeedback and research in that area. So that must have been an interesting aspect of your career. How did you get interested in that?
I was interested then in behavioral medicine, and at that point there was a Yale Behavioral Medicine Clinic, and Gary Schwartz was a visiting professor in the psychology department, and they had a liaison with the medical school so that the behavioral medicine clinic was in two sites. One was at the medical school and one was inside the psychology department. In fact, the sleep lab was in the psychology department, and so I was just hanging around there. I think I was going to a class, but it felt like I was hanging around. And you just absorb so much of what's going on. People, so many bright people would just say, well, here's how you put the EEG cap on, and this is what we're looking at here, and this is all of this, this is this, this is that, and it was very nice to absorb all that.
So now, when you say you do that in your practice, do you have to buy extra equipment and everything to be able to do that?
You do, and the equipment ranges in expense from probably $30,000, but $10,000 for me, down to basically toys, which are $150. I have everything, and I use the whole range of things.
What's a biofeedback toy? I gotta ask.
A biofeedback toy. Well, I will recommend Journey to the Wild Divine is actually an adventure game that uses blood volume pulse, which is a type of heart rate detector, and skin conductance, and you go through a series of tasks and like in any adventure game, you get stuff in your inventory for succeeding in this task. But the tasks require you to calm to challenges. Well, actually, they require you to amp up for some challenges and calm for others and keep in the midline for some and doing extremes for others. So basically arousal management, arousal control, increase self-regulation. You get rewarded for it under different levels of difficulty. And you get stuff. But you don't have to do it that way. In my office, I just pick out the different tasks and we go through them as needed. And that's $175 for the whole.
It's like a computer program, but it comes with equipment?
With the equipment.
Like the Wii Fit.
Yes. It's not highly sensitive, so you really need to get a good change in your arousal to make the graphics change on the monitor, whereas with the sensitive equipment you can learn much more quickly. But it's fun and the graphics are the best I've seen.
What sort of problems do people benefit from psychophysiological interventions? I mean, obviously you mentioned anxiety disorders. What about things like ADHD?
Yes, ADHD, primarily the EEG or the neurofeedback, which I don't do much of, but some people are doing heart rate variability feedback for ADHD, migraines, people have used biofeedback for a lot of different stress-related symptoms, and even addictions and depression, though I think it's really only got a high rating for anxiety, headaches, and ADD.
Great. Well, I'm going to stop asking questions. In the last 10 minutes, I wanted to keep all of these interviews open for the class. So if you have a question, just raise your hand for Dr. Smith. Yes, Ada.
You mentioned your favorite part about your job. I was wondering, is there anything, is there something least favorite that you don't like, or anything you don't like at all?
So my least favorite time, I thought about this, and it's pretty clear. It's at first I thought it would be battling with the insurance companies to get paid, but there's something worse than that. That is, on days when I have two borderline personality disorders on the same day, that will zing me not only for that day, but for the couple of days ahead and several days afterward. Those are tough, tough patients.
Is it because of the energy that it takes to get you through that session that you just sort of feel drained afterwards?
I feel drained. Working with someone with borderline personality disorder, you will feel every emotion. You will walk on water and feel like God, mm-hmm. Which it makes it hard for you not to buy into that because it's so nice. But you know what's coming next, in that you will feel like you are so inept as to be harmful to the human race, just terrible mixture of Darth Vader and Adolf Hitler and
you, oh my God.
Yes, you don't want to.
And Donald Trump.
And Donald Trump. You know at that point you want a distance from it, but it's very hard to, because a good borderline will really take you on that ride. So it's really tough.
Shannon.
Did you say you work with all ages, or do you have a certain age
limit? That's a good question. I work with adults and late adolescents clinically, but I do work with all ages for performance enhancement.
Rodrigo.
What would you say is the most challenging thing to gaining a client's trust, so allowing them to get into their setting?
To foster trust, you really need to have a benevolent intent where you're really looking at behavior as a little bit apart from the person that you assume is valuable right from the get-go, and even if they're engaging in these annoying or repulsive provocative behaviors, it's the behaviors that you're talking about, and the way you convey that is in your tone and your body posture, that you can be a valuable human being in spite of the way you create hatred or harm in other people. Then they're more likely, not everyone will drop their defenses a little, but if they test you on that, which usually means they harm you in a small way, a little insult or not paying you the copay or being late to the session, but somehow they want to see if they get you angry, are you going to use what you know to shred them, or are you going to respond in a growth-oriented way? So yeah, you'll get tested.
Some of that sounded a little Rogerian. Do you find yourself bringing other traditions and approaches into your practice, or is it mainly still psychodynamic?
I happen to think that they all distill to the same basic premise. I'm predominantly psychodynamic, but I do didactic work, psychophysiology. There's very much behavioral stuff there.
Sure.
There's a lot of everything.
Am I missing anyone behind me?
Yes.
Yes, Barbara.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the exams for licensing?
The exam for licensing, it's pretty straightforward. You apply to that state's licensing board, and it's usually online now. They tell you everything you need to know and everything you need to do. You need to have graduated from an APA-approved program, an APA-approved internship for clinical psychology. So know that while you're choosing your programs.
What type of questions? Do they give you, like, case studies?
So, there's two components. One is the big national exam. It's like the national boards that everybody has to know, basic clinical psychology knowledge. And then each state has their own tests on their own state rules and regulations, which vary. And so for the state ones, you have to memorize all the statutes. Very straightforward.
Jake?
What would be the most common diagnosis that you see, and what specifically do you do with athletes?
Two questions. Okay, so the most common diagnosis is... I know, it's adjustment disorder with mixed mood depression and anxiety, or adjustment disorder with depression, or adjustment disorder with... anxiety. I do see major depressions and I do see general anxiety disorders. I try and give the minimally severe diagnosis as possible, and still be truthful. But so I by far do adjustment disorders. And what do I do with athletes?
Yeah.
So, let's see, teams, and we're working with team dynamics and how to empower each other and not tear them down, so that when you go out together, you're all better than you would be individually. It's leadership, communication, a lot of team dynamics and how you treat each other. And then for individuals, I'll divide that into two. With individuals, so we work through the issues that people are carrying, that are burdens that come with them on the field or the court, and so that they are carrying less anxiety and less burdens, increasing coping, working through issues, making them have less distress. And on the other hand, we strengthen their attention control so that whatever distress level they have, they can still perform their motor sequences. Because if you go to the Olympics, It's a huge amount of stress. You can't assume that you can only play well with low levels of distress. So we want to really groove the attention control and the resiliency so that even if we didn't over here reduce the distress, they could still perform well.
Do you sometimes work with a coach more than the athletes?
I'm just starting to do that. I haven't, but just starting now, yeah.
Sounds like you think you might like that.
I do like that, yeah.
All right. One last time.
Sorry, because this really has to do with what you said, and that was my question. I'm a coach, but I wanted to know the advice, like your most, what you feel would be the best thing to help, valuable information to help athletes perform their best. Coach girls.
Worse. One thing, I don't know if I can do that. Is this a team? I would have to say the intervention results in everyone who's wearing the same outfit as yours, the same uniform, gets treated with a specially high level of respect, even if you don't like them. So that you have respect behaviors you engage in. Even if you don't agree with this person, you are a respectful teammate. And that includes not lying. It includes addressing them one-to-one, not going behind their back, And supporting them, acknowledging at least one comment a day, and spreading that around the team, basically reducing a lot of the negativity of people who are competing for positions but actually trying to work together, and teaching them behaviors as default behaviors to engage in just because you're wearing the same colors.
To finish up, and this has been tremendous, it's exceeded my expectations wonderfully, so thank you so much.
You're so validating.
What? You must be a psychologist in here. What would be one piece of advice you would give to somebody who wants to get into clinical psychology, who's starting out in the field?
The hardest part is getting into graduate school. Once you're in, you still have to do a lot of hard work, but nice job. Keep it up until you get in. Maintain your connection with what sustains you, if it's people or if it's ice hockey or whatever endeavor, because graduate school is extremely stressful, and you can't know everything. You can't be perfect. You'll try, and you'll have to sacrifice sleep and a lot of different things, and that may work well for you in the beginning, but that's not sustainable. So try to keep what sustains you, because a depleted you is not a you that you want to bring to your patients.
Great answer. It reminds me, we do a workshop here for how to get into graduate school every year. And I've developed over the years a little questionnaire that I give to all the students who come. And it's basically like, do you mind being criticized constantly? Do you mind feeling like you're not living up to anyone's expectations? Do you feel like, you know, someone's looking over your shoulder and finding fault in everything? You know, it's just like a lot of horrible questions.
Come to graduate school.
And that's right. That's like, if you get a low score on that, I'm like, you might not be ready for graduate school. It's such a stressful experience. Let's thank Dr. Smith.
Thank you very much.